Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 139 with Aaron Fragnito on million-dollar wholesaling and multifamily apartments. Aaron has been in the real estate business since 2010, starting as a real estate agent, then evolving to short sales to eventually building a million-dollar-per-year wholesaling business. He has now focused his efforts on buying and repositioning multifamily deals in northern New Jersey. I admire Aaron's investment philosophy when it comes to rental real estate, as well as some other mindset stuff we're going to talk about here today. But specifically, I like the way that he buys in areas where he and his team can physically visit the property, check on and manage the assets by jumping in a car. I am a control freak when it comes to managing my own properties, so I like that with Aaron. So let's jump right in, shall we? All right, welcome to the show, Aaron. How you doing today?
Pretty good, Dan. Good doing here, working hard, making things happen.
Nice, I like it. So I'm, as most of the audience knows already, recording from my my Chicago location, right over the lake here. A nice summer day here in August 2019. Whereabouts are you recording from, Aaron?
I'm in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. I'm looking out over a lovely parking lot. And yeah, my view isn't as amazing as I'd like, but it's okay. There's some grass in there, so it works.
Nice. Yeah, it's summertime, so we don't have a lot to complain about here in Chicago. The other time of the year, you know, frozen over, tundra. Yeah, you can hear a lot of people ready to move out of here. But all that aside, Aaron, for the listeners who may not know who you already are, would you mind giving the Reader's Digest kind of version of maybe, you know, how you started in real estate, a little bit of the progression and sort of where your businesses have evolved to today?
Sure. Well, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad when I was graduating college as an entrepreneur major, and I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I know I wanted to be an entrepreneur of some type, but that's a very vague term. And I realized I actually had a passion for real estate, so I bought a bunch of actually Trump University books and a bunch of like David Lindall books and things like that. Started reading all about it, knew absolutely nothing. Just started calling brokers on LoopNet. And I was actually, after I graduated college, I moved to Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and I was a ski instructor for 6 months. And that's when I did all this research and found my passion for real estate. And I made a list of, you know, where I wanted to be in 10 years. And I wanted to have $1 million net worth, a positive cash flow. And I said, okay, how do I get there? Well, the first step was get my real estate license, you know, learn the industry and build up from there. So I went back home to Jersey and I did that and made about $500 in my first 6 months. It was 2010. No one was buying a house. It was completely dismal. I just totally failed as a realtor for like 6 months and then finally started to get some traction with short sales. And I totally learned short sales, developed a list of buyers, investors for short sales. And I would call expired short sale listings and say, I have a buyer for your listing and they're doing it wrong. You know, they listed it too high. And here's where, and I worked with a short sale negotiating company and I had my investors make the offers and I had a whole system in place. It was really good. So I started churning out short sales and learned, the system there and made some good commissions and teamed up with my business partner today, Seth Martinez, who I was selling properties to with as a broker in Newark. And I liked the way he lowballed all these sellers and they'd always get annoyed and no other realtors would take his business because he'd lowball everyone. I didn't mind it. I learned a lot from him. I said, I like the way this guy does business. And he's more of an operator, kind of type A, organized. I'm very type B. I'm more out there and I like talking to people, I'm a people person. So we really complement each other's weaknesses and we built up from there, renovated, leased up, refinanced, two families, three families, got a sixth family, got up to 100 doors, raised capital, developed a management company and, fired a couple along the way as well. And, here we are today.
Nice. Are the short sales still working at all? Do you still do those deals?
We do actually. I mean, they're few and far between. They're nowhere near what they were years ago, but the same guy. I had the same team in place, the very good negotiators. And, you know, if you know how to do them, there's some money to make. But, you know, the bank's not giving them away like they used to either. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm kind of finding that we close on, I don't know, a handful per year. We have like 25 or 30 in the pipeline. And the only ones that seem to fly are the ones that need like a complete full renovation, because I want them for like the numbers that Seth Martinez was offering. Personally, that's how Dan Breslin's buying properties. I need them for a good deal. I got to be able to make a profit just like you. And it seems like the banks, that's only a good fit, I'm finding, when the bank has a property and we're negotiating something that's like not retail ready. Anything that's retail ready, I just tell the team, like, forget it. Give it to one of the agents. Let them deal with it. Have them bring a retail buyer. That's kind of a pass. I mean, is that like what you're finding also lately, 10 years later?
Yeah, yes and no. It depends on the area. If it's inner city and there's a large array of comps, we can still get deals on like stuff in decent condition, but it's much harder. I'd say we're 50% successful with short sales, and there's just so much less of them. You know, I have a fraction of that going on from what you've going on with short sales. I'm probably doing maybe one every 2 months now. You know, I just don't come across them that often. Our main bread and butter for deals is actually share sales.
Nice. Yeah, we're gonna touch on that a little bit here in a second. Before we do, Chicago is a different beast. So I'm in Chicago, I'm in Atlanta, I'm in Tampa, Florida, Miami, Florida, and we are in Philadelphia market. And we have like one short sale that we're potentially working in Philly. Chicago just has a large number of foreclosure filings. We're probably one of the higher foreclosure rated markets right now in the country in Chicago. So we still see a little bit of a volume, but we're also talking about a metro of like 8 million, 9 million people here. So just definitely more of those opportunities are crossing our desk. I hear a lot about sheriff sale deals myself, Aaron. How did you make the transition into that? How do you deal with all the competition on the courthouse steps in that auction environment and actually get good deals?
Sure. Well, about 4 years ago, I was sitting at a closing table buying a two family, and the guy got it at auction. He was making like 60 grand, the wholesale fee, assignment fee, and I bought the place. I renovated it. We came out with like a $5,000 profit on the flip. It was not a very successful flip. But I realized, you know, the guy making the money was the guy who bought it. So I called that guy up. I took him out to lunch, picked his brain. And he pretty much told me everything he did about the business. And then I was going to work with him, actually. We were going to work together. And he just never sent me the information to follow up and work together. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to go do this. So we did it. We have capital. We're people's capital groups. So we raise capital, so we can usually make a phone call and get together some cash pretty quickly. And so we were able to go to auction and really start getting in there heavy. We had drivers going here in New Jersey. There is a lot of inventory. You know, we can do three or four counties in a week and be reviewing hundreds of properties coming to auction. So in 2016 and 2017, it was a gold mine. There was ton of properties. More and more people started coming towards 2017, 2018. Word got out. That's where all the deals were. And all the deals were there. We would make a killing at the sheriff sale auctions. We netted over $1 million in wholesale profits each year, and just completely made hay while the sun shined in 2016 and 2017. And then it started to dwindle out in 2018. Everyone and their mom was there at the auctions. The bidding was going through the roof. We were not getting nearly the deals we want to get. But we still go today. We go to three auctions. We cycle about $1 million through three different counties here. It's a very cash-intensive process. And, you know, there's just a lot of competition now. You know, we still kind of have a driver system. We still have our property manager helps with some of the due diligence on the property. There's a kind of a process. Each county is a little different. It's kind of hard to replicate county to county because each county is different. So it's not an easy way to scale always with these properties. It's very cash intensive as well with the auctions. But we still do well there. We're still able to pick up roughly a deal every 2 weeks. But the spreads are less. You know, I got crazy deals. I mean, I got some stuff for like 30 grand. I turn around and I remember one day I got a two family for $30,000. I turned around and signed a contract to assign it for $130,000 the next day.
Nice.
Printing money. Yeah, it was crazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we also, we used to be primarily a wholesale company years ago. I always wanted to flip houses ever since I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Before I went to college, after I failed out of college, I think I circled back and read it again. But anyway, that was always my thing. I wanted to like fix and flip properties. And we were like trying to do that and then do some wholesaling. Anyway, we saw that same kind of a peak, if you will, in the wholesale spreads, a few years ago. So like 2015, 2016, 2017. It seemed like it was a printing money scenario, and we're more of a direct to seller, sending out letters, that kind of thing. We were doing, you know, a lot more assignment contracts and transactions then, and it's, we seemed to notice the same thing that you just described, where in 2018, I don't know, I guess there's too many gurus out there teaching it. Everyone and their mother, you know, now is a real estate wholesaler, and the spreads start to tighten up, and there's just a ton of competition out there in the market. So we've kind of transitioned, you know, especially here in the Chicago market and Philly market, to doing more renovations. You know, we also raise capital. We have several $1 million on the street at any given time throughout each of those markets, but we're doing a lot more of the renovations and kind of taking the deal all the way through the process. Are you doing any of that, or do you guys pretty much keep it to, hey, we're only going to buy it and then resell it with not any renovations involved? Or do you get involved in some of those like retail renovation flips?
Yeah, I mean, we are always changing our model as well. We I've done probably 40 fix and flips in our that's just like buy, fix and sell like single family homes, right? So we did a lot of that in 2013, 14, 15, and then right, you know, we started to realize we actually took some hits on some high-end stuff. So we did really well on the low-end flips. We did pretty well on the mid-level flips. And then we're like, oh, well, we're so good at flipping houses. Why don't we start flipping million-dollar houses? And we used the same contractor crews to flip million-dollar houses and lost our shirt. So we totally – that was around 2016 as well. So part of our business was completely on fire. You know, the wholesaling was doing phenomenal and was just an ATM machine. And then the flipping, the fix and flips were just a disaster. So, you know, we kind of recalibrated at that point. We stopped doing the fix and flips. We have 10,000 buyers on our buyers list. So we have a lot of investors. It's hard to find inventory in New Jersey. That's everyone's complaint. There's no inventory. Everything's too expensive, da, da, da. So we were the one-stop shop where you could find deals, and we just churned them out like a used car lot. We bring them in. We'd lock them up at auction, put that in the 20%. We knew how to converse with the attorneys working for the lien holders to buy ourselves 60 to 90 days to assign the bid. We would assign the bid, and I would take very little risk. I'm not even buying the real estate. I'm not insuring. I'm just putting down 20% and assigning the bid. You know, talk to an attorney and whatever you're doing that, of course. But we figured out how to do it the right way here, and very lucrative and low risk as well. For the most part, you're putting down 20%, but there's ways to get that back as well. So yeah, I mean, it was a tough time learning and recalibrating. And I think fix and flips is one of the hardest dollars to make in this business. Maybe I'm just not that good at it, but I'm more of a commercial real estate guy. The apartment buildings, I think, are incredible source of revenue. And then wholesaling is just like a flow of deals that if you know how to wholesale properly, you might not be making a killing on every single one of them. In fact, some of them might be small losses, but you know, you're not going to lose your shirt wholesaling. You know?
Yeah, you're right about that. There's definitely a different level of risk, a different level of attention to detail management of the contractors, the process, the timeline is longer. We are blessed to have some pretty decent crews in some markets. In some markets, we're challenged to get through some of the product in, you know, a long time, and we're pulling our hair out. But, you know, nature of the beast. It's funny how things change and don't last forever and modify. We're literally in the Chicago market now. They just signed into law that you now need a real estate license in order to market assignment contracts. So we're kind of hoping that a lot of the competition will shake out, or maybe they'll get licensed. I don't know. Or maybe no one will care about the law and they'll just continue to go on with the level of competition that we've seen. But it's just odd to see. It's not odd. I mean, it's just the nature of time progressing to see things kind of modify and evolve and have to adjust our process, et cetera. So you mentioned, I forget, you said you had 100 units and you just mentioned the apartment buildings. Can you talk about your transition, your evolution, if you will, into these larger commercial deals and maybe where you see that going so far?
Sure. So People's Capital Group started with the goal of getting 1,000 units over 3 years, which was very ambitious and slightly unrealistic, considering we didn't really have any money raised when we were starting the company. So that was in 2013. We quickly acquired about 100 units, but we were it was just recently sold about 40 of them. So we kind of cut the pork. We had some lesser real estate that wasn't quite cash flowing, and we're now moving that equity, that cash from the sale into some better real estate. And we're looking for Class B real estate, or Class C that we move into Class B. But my passion was always really in the commercial real estate, especially multifamily, apartment buildings, mixed use. And we've always had that part of our business, but we got very tied up in the residential stuff through the years. We have been acquiring buildings and just building our process there. So we started with a 25 unit in South Jersey around 2013 and bought it and spruced it up, kind of put all the money we were making on the property back into the property. And we sold it about 2.5 years later and made a good profit for our investors. And at the same time also started buying a lot of sixes and twos and threes. And we had a management company that was stealing money from us. So we had to fire them and take them to court. And I won. And we developed our own management company through necessity really fine-tuned the process. You know, I figured out that property management companies really don't want to reposition your apartment buildings for you. They want to collect the rent, and they want to call a plumber when a pipe leaks, and that's about it. So, you know, if you really want to reposition buildings aggressively, I found I did need to develop my own company. I know there are good management companies out there. I just couldn't seem to find any here in New Jersey that were going to reposition my buildings for any reasonable cost. And so that's one of our greatest strengths and allowed us to really build value into the real estate and raise more capital. And so we're focused more on buying apartment buildings now. We've done very well with that in the past, and we're buying 6 to 25 unit buildings now. And about 80% of my time is focused on fundraising and branding, and my partner's time is mostly spent on operations, finding the next building, managing the management company, overseeing the repositions. And so it's what nice little challenges there every day for both of us. We have a good system in place now, and you know, it's interesting. The hardest part's actually finding a good deal. You know, the money's there, but finding a good deal is the hardest part in commercial real estate here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's everybody's kind of terminology right now as we speak here in 2019, and there's another rate decrease with the Fed coming down the pike. I imagine that's going to only make it tougher. We had the recent tax code, which has the accelerated depreciation ability. So like that also continues to stoke the commercial real estate world. Dave mm-hmm. Lindahl actually came on the show a while ago. I'll make sure to put a note in the deal notes. In the show notes, I'll make a link so that Dave's episode is available there as well. But Dave and I talked about, and he wrote his book that you obviously read, and you know, I've been to some of his seminars, and he's big on finding the growth markets and selecting, you know, kind of those areas. And I think, you know, 2013, 2012, like that was an obvious strategy. You could plunk down and grab something, you know, Atlanta and Texas and all these markets that have been pretty strong with employment going forward. Are you using an investment philosophy like that, where you're investing all over the country, like many of the guests have come on my show and talked about, or do you like to be able to drive to your, you know, South Jersey's probably, I guess, an hour or two from Berkeley Heights, I assume. You could drive to any of your product there. Are you in your backyard investing and looking for these deals, or do you hop on planes and go all over the country and chasing of those markets?
Now, so we are strictly New Jersey. We focus on about everything from an hour from our office, which is a ton of inventory in North Jersey. There's like five or six cities right around us. So we do have a good amount of inventory to pick from. But the competition is fierce. Since we manage everything in-house, it does limit how far we can comfortably go, you know, and I guess that can be a strength and weakness. So, you know, right now we like to stick to what we know. We've had bad experiences hiring outside management companies, going more than 60 minutes away from our office here. Both of those have, we've had success, but also challenges with that as well. So we've got a good system here. You know, kind of like if it isn't broke, don't fix it. You know, we are able to find deals. We have about 3,000 people in our RIA. We have brokers, we have wholesalers, we have people that, you know, good network here, good boots on the ground. And so we do have a lot of success, you know, kind of finding deals, matching them up with local investors, raising capital. People like the idea that you can drive out to the properties, they're all local, because, you know, if you want to invest in a syndicate, there's not a lot of them doing New Jersey right now. You know, I mean, I follow all my competitors and colleagues, and I know like one other guy doing something in Jersey, but it's a resort. It's not what I'm doing. It's not multifamily existing buildings. You know, sure, there's development and stuff, but that's, again, that's different. So, you know, I'm really, I offer a turnkey passive investment opportunity to investors with great tax benefits and long-term tax benefits to the apartment buildings. And, you know, it's going to be a little bit lesser returns, though, than some of these guys are earning out in Texas or South Carolina. And hey, if they can get on a plane and go, you know, buy a building, that's awesome. More power to them. Maybe one day we'll be doing that as well. But there's also a lot to be said to investing in your own neighborhood and knowing each block. You know, in Newark, New Jersey, I can tell you which block's good, which block's bad. And you know, that's a very important thing to know. And quite frankly, investing in a city like Newark, New Jersey, I don't know how you would do it if you lived in Chicago. You know, you have to know the city so, so well that the people on your team just have to be all stars, you know, and that's, you're so reliant on your team. You know, we've had challenges with that. And so right now we're trying to stick to what we know, what we do best, you know?
Yeah. And I'm always curious. I mean, I don't know any horror stories, off the top of my head, but our economic conditions have been very good since 2010, 2011. They may not have been great in 2010, 2011, if that's when somebody got in the business. But I see a lot of operators who are raising a lot of money, and I'm just curious how things are going to shake out as we see some economic conditions change. And I don't know if that's going to be this year, next year, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. But at some point, you know, you're really placing a bet as a private investor on somebody who's going to operate multifamily housing on your behalf. For me, I prefer, like you, I prefer to just own the properties myself personally. I don't like to raise money. I don't want to have a lot of other people's capital at risk. This is just my own personal investment philosophy. I also don't want to have 10 different operators with, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 of my money, that I'm betting on these horses, if you will, or these jockeys to run those deals the right way. You know, for a myriad of reasons, I prefer to have my money invested in a smaller number of places so that in the event of my demise and I die, my family has an easier time sorting things out than if I, you know, place money in 20 different people's hands. I also like the idea, just like you're in your backyard. You know the streets, you know the blocks. Yeah, maybe there's not 300 or 400 or 500 unit complexes that are going to be easily available in Newark because there's such a constrained real estate market, just like Philadelphia, just like Chicago, versus Atlanta, where there's a ton of land that's open and you could build a 300 unit, a 400, a 500 unit. You still could build in the last 20, 30 years with all the open land there. Newark has been built up forever. Chicago has been built up forever. So I think it restricts us who are going to invest locally to maybe like the smaller buildings, certainly to get started. I personally like the idea of a 6 or an 8 or a 10 unit building. what I've observed in Chicago, there's a lot of that product. There's a ton of six flats, eight flats, three flats, four flats, and they have a tendency in certain neighborhoods when you buy them for $250,000, 5 years later, they're worth $550,000. You buy them for $450,000, maybe put $100,000 in them, 5 years later, they're worth $850,000. So there's this like run-up that I've witnessed occur in a Chicago market in a smaller multifamily segment there, where it's not completely driven off a cap rate, and you still have the opportunity for people to have their egos come in and plunk down and buy these like properties at numbers that, you know, may not necessarily make sense, like if you're playing in an arena with a 100 or 200 unit building. And I don't know. I'm not the guy doing the 100 unit deals, so I'm sure he's probably thinking, Dan, you're, you know.
And also you're dealing with just a mom and pop scenario there. You know, if you're trying to buy a 6 unit or an 8 unit, and we buy, you know, 6 to 25 units, and there's a number of reasons for that. But one of the reasons is you're dealing with a mom and pop negotiation generally. Especially if you're direct to the owner and there's no brokers involved, you know, and that's a much easier conversation. And that's where us savvy investors get deals. When we're direct to the owner, we can sit them down and talk to them and show our integrity and build some rapport. And maybe it takes them 6 months to agree to sign a contract with us, but my business partner is phenomenal at that. He'll just chat with these old guys, you know, 80 years old, they've acquired a number of buildings, and you know, we're their guys. We're going to buy them from you one by one. We're going to help you retire. We're not going to nickel and dime you. We need it the right price. But at the end of the day, we're going to close and do what we said we're going to do. So I love negotiating with, you know, mom and pop owners. It's a lot easier than institutions, which tend to own 100 unit or 200 units, and you're dealing with very savvy brokers. And those are a whole different negotiating processes. And there's values to scaling up like that as well, but there's a bigger buyer pool for small stuff, so they tend to go for better prices, as you were saying, per unit, and the negotiation with the seller is better, and there's just more of them, so finding them is easier.
Nice. What about the tenant population in there? I mean, was there any reasoning for selecting that size? Does that behave in a way that's close to single family? Just talk about how that tenant interaction actually occurs.
Yeah, so we work with a lot with Section 8 buildings, affordable housing. We do inner city areas a lot, so we're very familiar with that process. You know, it's an acquired taste, especially Section 8. You get an annual inspection every year. We've had tenants that'll destroy the unit, and every year, you know, you end up fixing the unit because you got to pass that inspection to get paid by Section 8. So you really got to pick and choose your tenants. You still want to do background checks and credit checks and landlord checks and references, even if they have a Section 8 voucher. But we also do affordable housing, where we just bought a 14-unit a condo complex in Berkeley Heights here, right down the street from our office. And it's affordable housing, which expires in 6 years, which opens up the door for a lot of options. And some nice value add down the road there. It's a good purchase price as well, good building. So the tenant, you know, but getting tenants is easy. There's a line out the door usually for any of our rentals. Granted, we put it at the right price. And in fact, we get more than we project a lot of times for rent. All right. So sometimes we pay a little more than we want for the real estate, but we get more than we think we're going to get for rent. And we have a bigger selection of tenants, therefore allowing us to select a better tenant. And you know, quality over quantity is what we've learned with tenants. We're not afraid to say no if someone doesn't check out. Or if our property manager just has a bad feeling as well. You know, she's been leasing units here with us for long enough that, you know, you start to understand, you know, what type of individual you're dealing with if you talk to them for a few minutes or so. And you know, just some tips to, like, we always kind of look at, like, how do they, you know, what kind of car do they drive, or how do they keep themselves? How do they hold themselves? Do they have manners? You know, these are all things that are important for integrity as well. You know, are they going to treat our property manager nicely, or are they going to scream at her and swear at her and, you know, try to get out of paying rent all the time? So, you know, when you're working with Class C and Class D real estate, as we did getting started, you learn how to really smell the BS sometimes. And you know, that's the hardest part of renting with Section 8 and affordable housing. You know, well, affordable housing is different because the tenants pay their own rent, so that they tend to be working class. Section 8, the government's paying their rent. So they rarely have skin in the game. Sometimes maybe it's $100 a month or $200 a month. And so you just have to make sure the tenants still are going to have pride of ownership. And that's not always found in Section 8. But yeah, the leasing part's pretty easy here in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could go on and on about Section 8. Not a huge fan. I prefer when they're paying their own bills. I know a lot of people like to have the rent on time when it comes, but that's probably a topic, I guess, for a whole nother day. So let's talk about, you mentioned a little bit the returns that were available. Are you kind of like raise a fund of $1 million and then put the million to work, or do you raise groups of cash when, you know, the 14 unit kind of building deal comes up and then you're hopping on the phone and raising it? So is it more of like a pool that you then invest, or is it like a deal by deal that you invest? And what are some of the returns examples of some of those that you've done?
So for each acquisition, we start a new LLC and a new little fund. I have a 506C and a 506B, so I can work with accredited and sophisticated investors. I basically take pledges from investors, which is just it's a non-binding document that says, you know, I agree to invest this amount of money. And, yeah, they're going to still review the deal, but you know, that's what I do. I don't actually take the capital and put it in a fund just yet. But I do have relationships, prior existing relationships with tons of investors, and it's a first come, first serve basis for, you know, upcoming acquisitions. And, you know, we're always looking to team up with new investors. You know, I actually have investors with deep pockets who can, I have a deal right now, I'm putting together about $400,000 for it. Small acquisition of about $1 million building in Paterson, New Jersey here. Great reposition strategy, though. It's going to really be a home run, I think. So anyway, I'm raising about 400 for it. I have one guy who wants to do a whole thing, and I'm leaning towards doing that because he's a good investor, and I want to put his money to work. But he's going to be there, you know, long term, and we have a good relationship. And quite frankly, I'd rather work with four or five new investors whom I meet through my RIA, my meetup group, and just networking and speaking out at other RIAs and whatnot, and marketing and branding and our online social media. So, you know, I'd rather connect with those and get the new relationships going. So that's what we focus on. We're always trying to connect with new investors. We do about one acquisition every quarter. We do have one coming down the pike right now, which we're creating a fund for and accepting interest in from investors. And we try to line up one for the final quarter here as well. Our last reposition, our investors earned 11.5% cash on cash return. Annualized. Okay. So it was, we bought it, 25 unit. Now we sold it, 2.5 years later, and, annualized cash on cash returns, 11.5%, not including any tax benefits, of course. And, so that was, a good investment there. And, on other investments, our investors have earned above 12% cash on cash. Every deal is a little different. You know, getting started, we probably gave some sweetheart deals out to investors as well. And now, we do equity positions with investors, and we project about 10 to 11% cash on cash returns each year. And then, depending on if you sell your share or if you stay in the, LLC long term, you can accept tax benefits as well and, tax depreciation. And that'll put you up around a 14 or 15% internal rate of return. And that's a little more comparable with some of those Texas guys and out of state guys, you know, so we can get those internal rates of return up to the mid teens here in Jersey. It just has to be a bit of a longer term investment. And by the way, just the way we kind of structure our exits is a little more unique. So we actually refinance every 3 to 5 years, and we give the investors the option to sell their share in the LLC upon the refinance. So they, you know, harvest their returns, you know, from the refinance. Everyone gets a big fat check at the refinance. And then, the investor wants to sell their share, we'll buy out their share for the initial investment amount so they can get back their initial investment. So, you know, they enjoy a cash flow every year, every quarter, tax write-offs at the end of the year, tax depreciation, and then a big lump sum at the refi. But if you don't sell your share at the refi and you stay in long term, the tax benefits are just phenomenal. And then we do a 1031 tax deference, and really just avoid paying taxes indefinitely. It's an incredible tool. We take advantage of it.
Nice. So what is your typical deal timeline? Are we talking 3 to 5 years, then a refi, and then another 3 to 5 years in a sale? Or is it kind of a case-by-case basis, or you're really not sure going into the deal whether the market's going to perform, you know, to the level that you're going to want to sell or hang on to it at the end of each five-year chunk, let's say?
Mm-hmm. So we are buying in an area that we expect long-term growth, okay? Some can argue New York City is the greatest city in the world, and we play off the greatest city in the world. So right here, we're all within, we buy within train stations that can get you to Manhattan in 45 minutes to 60 minutes, okay? So we're in commuter towns. So we feel long-term, this is a great place to build your wealth. So we really don't ever plan on selling the real estate until we exhaust the tax depreciation, which is 27 and a half years from now. So the investors, of course, can sell their share every 3 to 5 years when we refinance, and that gives them a lot more options. And we're kind of impartial. We can buy your share or not. It's really, we don't really mind either way. But if you, you know, again, if you stay in long term, we're just going to keep refinancing every 3 to 5 years, split them a bunch of cash, keep forcing value into the building here. There's a number of different reposition strategies. So we'll have like a 1 to 5 year reposition strategy, which is tends to be very aggressive. Obviously dozens of different things you do to get the income up and get your expenses down on apartment buildings. And then we'll have a 5 to 10 year, reposition strategy, which tends to involve maybe solar panels, becoming the electric company, just another level of reposition. And then a 10 to 15 year reposition strategy, which is hard to always predict. That's outside, you know, such a long timeline, but continue to force value of the property a number of different ways. We kind of give our investors the options to sell every 3 to 5 years or just stay in indefinitely. And about 8 to 10 years, they'll make their entire investment back. And then it's just gravy beyond that. And of course, we do a 1031 tax deference. You really just can avoid paying taxes indefinitely. So that's our goal. You know, we're more of like a tax-minded syndication.
Gotcha. So let's talk about, you know, it sounds like long-term growth, Newark. It sounds like that's all pretty good stuff. And I found that my own investment philosophy changes over the years. I like to buy in areas where I'm going to see potential for gentrification. I love South Philadelphia for that reason. There's some areas here in Chicago that I've bought. I'll buy mm-hmm. other areas that are cash flow and for other reasons. I might like product myself in those other areas. I like the idea of Newark being long-term, beneficial mm-hmm. location to Manhattan. That makes sense. But I'm guessing it probably wasn't always that way. Do you have any like mistakes or buildings, like maybe the one you got rid of already that you just didn't like it for some reason? You kind of like share that as a little bit of a lesson to somebody who might be ready to make the same mistake inadvertently?
Sure. Well, we bought a property on Sunset Ave, which is also known as Gunset Ave in Newark, New Jersey. And, looked really sexy on paper, right? And it was one of those cash flowing deals where like, oh, it's not a great area, but it's going to cash flow, right? So yeah, of course it will. So someone was murdered in front of the property the day after we bought it. Pretty sad. There's a memorial in front of it and everything. And it was just a really bad area. I would go there to lease it. This is when I was very active in the management and leasing of buildings. I'm also a realtor. And I did not feel comfortable. Literally, people would try to open my car doors while I was in the car. I don't know what the next plan was, but I didn't want to find out, you know. So it is basically a really bad area. And they were just completely selling drugs out of the building. They wouldn't listen to anything we would say. I would go there and be like, hey, stop selling drugs out of my building. They'd be like, get the hell off the porch or we're going to kill you. So, definitely a tough building. Cycle through tenants, learn the lesson of how to vet tenants properly. Finally got some decent tenants in there, but they were still just leasing out every single bedroom. It was really sad. You would go there and there'd be like, just broken glass and drugs everywhere. And there'd be like kids walking around in the dark. And we'd be trying to enforce a level of quality in the building and just constantly putting money into it and telling the tenants to take their trash out and clean up after themselves. And, you know, if people don't want to take care of themselves, you just can't, you can bring a horse to water. You can't make them drink. So it was just a really bad experience. We actually didn't lose all that much money. I think we were able to refinance pretty quickly, and we have really good bank relationships. So some banks are just like, fine, we'll just give you the money. So we were able to refinance pretty quickly and get our initial investment back, and I don't think they ever really cash flowed all that much. We also had a really bad partner in on those deals who brought the capital in. He was an equity partner, and he ended up being an individual who we bought about 8 buildings with him, and the plan was to refinance all of them. We bought them, renovated them, we leased them up, we refinanced, and then unfortunately changed his mind upon the refinance at the closing table and said, nah, you know what, I'd rather not. I think you guys should just sell them and we should cash out. We said, well, you know, we've unfortunately renovated these for rental grade and we leased them up. And to sell a multifamily, you need to have a vacant unit because you need to sell, get an owner occupant FHA buyer most likely, and they're going to pay the most. You need a vacant unit for that. And they're not, they're fully leased with long-term leases. And this is a, you know, we have to refinance now. That's the whole plan. And he wouldn't cooperate. So we had to turn all the buildings around and sell them, and ended up being a really tough scenario there as well. So we learned two things, you know, location, 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 and pick and choose who you borrow money from, because even though the money's green, it might not be worth it. That was even a harder lesson, really.
Yeah, true enough. I've had that experience myself where, you know, sometimes a really cheap price will attract you, and really high cash flow, you know, you see like a 12 cap, a 13 cap or something crazy. It's taken me a few years and, you know, biting off a few of those deals and going through those same kind of scenarios. It's like, wow, I just can't believe that, you know, these tenants aren't taking care of the place and, aren't paying the bills. And then there's the gunshots out front and the calls from the police. The contractors don't want to go there. And I know that it's a really good feeling when I sold, you know, the one property that I'm thinking about and kind of got out from under it. I felt like the hot potato had been passed. And the lady who bought it, you know, she's living there. I guess she's doing okay, I'm sure. You know, she's from the area, from the neighborhood, maybe used to that kind of stuff. I was happy to get out. So I guess like my cautionary word of warning, I don't really have an example on your second piece where you got to pick the person that you're doing business with, other than like choosing the right business partners is really important. And people who are lending you money are, in a sense, your business partner. But that location thing, be aware of when the numbers look too good to be true, because they just might be.
Absolutely. Same with flips. I mean, flips are even harder to predict numbers on, you know, and that's really where we lost. Like, and usually in the multifamily are somewhat forgiving. You know, you could lease them up, you could refinance, you can't sell the thing, fine, just lease it up, just collect some rent, maybe down the road you could sell it. That was our strategy with that, it worked. But the single family flips were, you know, when we made mistakes on those, you paid for them because they were vacant, you got hard money loans on them, at least we did. And, you know, we're using the wrong contractors. And then when you bring in a new contractor, he says, well, the work the last contractor did is all wrong. So we have to rip up all the floors again and do it, you know. So you just get in a cycle of just putting money, good money at bad. And so if you're going to learn in the multifamilies. Buy a 2 or 3 family, I think, is your first flip. Because there's more forgiving, I think, than a single family flip, you know.
True enough. So, Aaron, for people that are listening right now, I'd like you to answer this question two ways, one of which being for the investor who's just getting started. And then the second way to answer the question would be for someone like me who's been in the business for like 13, 14 years, bought hundreds of deals, over 1,000 now at this point. What would be book recommendations for each of those individuals who are listening?
Well, getting started, I think Rich Dad, Poor Dad was probably, which I know the most common suggestion, but I that book changed my life. So it sticks out the most. Absolutely. As far as an experienced investor such as yourself, I listen to a lot of podcasts these days. I read articles. I got to be honest, I haven't picked up a real estate investment book in a while. I did listen to How to Raise Private Capital. I forget who the author was, but I did listen to that on Audible, and I thought that was pretty good for what I'm doing here. But I my job is to raise private capital, so that's why I listened to that book. I'm as far, I mean, I got a lot out of David Lindahl's books, you know, again, but they're probably pretty basic for what you're doing. But I always thought there was a lot of material there. So maybe David Lindahl will be my suggestion for an experienced investor.
You know? Nice. Well said. I know we talked about a lot of wisdom here, learned from the hard experience of our deals today, but if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself, like 2010, right when you were getting into business, what would that be?
I would say make a plan and think about that plan and try your best to stick to it, but tweak it as time goes. I don't think I really had a plan then. I mean, I guess I'd like to say I did, but it was just a grand scheme, really. You know, I think, you know, really what I've done to become a better businessman was set up systems, set up a real structure, you know, and I executed a whole business plan in 2013 and then went and did something else, you know, with the business. So it's like we got off track. So stay on track. If you're developing a plan, stick with it. Have patience. Be consistent. It's not going to happen right away. It takes years, especially if you're building wealth in commercial real estate. So, you know, make a good plan and stick to it would be my advice for young Aaron there. And don't flip
nice,
high and
happy. I remember a friend of mine. I got into business in 2006, and I sort of sounds like what you just mentioned, right? It was like whatever deals I did, I kind of like accidentally did them. They came down, they felt like a good deal, so we did the deal, you know, some wholesale, some rentals, some flip, whatever. But I was standing in a friend of mine, and he was just off the heels. I think he had like made his, you know, first $1 million profit year doing real estate, flipping houses, you know, wholesale and whatever. And we were like in his penthouse waterfront condo in Philadelphia. And I remember he was like, yeah, you know, it's crazy. I wrote a business plan and everything I wrote in that business plan happened. And I was like, huh. And it took me like a few years, maybe a year or two after that. But I remember specifically the light bulb going off at that moment. And I wrote the business plan probably in 2013. And I'm sure it modified and changed a little bit. And I didn't mention the markets that we're in, but all that stuff that I envisioned when I was sitting down working on that plan, it probably took a couple weeks. And, you know, obviously it's improved and changed and modified over the years. But just like he said years ago, everything that I put in that business plan, it all happened. And I remember it just seemed like such a miracle when he said it. And I almost could feel the miracle of my vision happening as I was putting the plan together. And then it actually started to happen in reality. So, wow, the importance of having that vision and putting it down on paper and thinking it through on the plan is some great crown jewel of wisdom, Aaron.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think my biggest challenge was executing the plan, and I'm very entrepreneurial minded, so I'm always looking at different opportunities and this and that. And I think I maybe spread myself too thin, you know, and I was doing high end flips and wholesaling and apartment buildings and da da da. Where the plan was apartment buildings, raise capital, reposition apartment buildings. So it's like, yeah, we kind of did, you know, we had the plan in 2013. We started to execute it. We did well with it. We got off track in 15, 16, 17. We recalibrated in 18. Now we're back to what we were doing in 2013, you know, but two times over now with a lot more resources to it. And, you know, I don't regret anything. I, you know, it helped me get to where I am today. It helped build the brand and connect with investors, and that's how we get our capital today from those years of flipping houses. Yeah, my passion is in commercial real estate, owning apartment buildings. And I think I got way off from the TV shows and all the fixer uppers that were for sale, how easy it was to get a cheap fixer upper in 2014, you know, so we got off track with that. And, so yes, always stick to the plan.
Cool. So if anyone is listening, Aaron, wants to get some more information about you, do you have a website or some contact information that you'd like to share?
Sure. Check out peoplescapitalgroup.com. It's our website, bunch of information on there. We have properties we're acquiring, properties we're already acquired. We have videos and educational videos. You can also check us out on YouTube. We have a bunch of videos in there, and hit the subscribe button. I'm trying to get up to 100 subscribers on YouTube, so hopefully we can get there soon. And, But yeah, peoplescapitalgroup.com is the best place to put in your information and contact us and learn more about our company. And please do, because we're quite active here and we do webinars and events and education. And of course, we are a great passive investment opportunity as well.
All right, cool. Well, I appreciate you blocking out all the distractions and sharing your wisdom and knowledge here with us today. So thank you for coming on the show, Aaron.
Thanks a lot, Dan. I had a great time. And you let me know when you want me back.
Sounds good. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. Chris Benson and I discuss the benefits of scaling to a $350 million portfolio in self-storage. As CIO of Reliant Real Estate, Chris helps fund the nearly $100 million per year acquisition appetite of this investment behemoth. Chris brings a ton of insight here, which applies to you and me, even if we are not doing self-storage or not yet doing hundreds of millions of dollars in real estate deals. Of course, I believe the best way to get to that next level is to observe and model the mindset of those who are already operating at that level. At least that's how I personally approached this episode. You won't want to miss it. Are you interested in a pre-release of that episode? That is, before the email goes out. When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when the email is sent. Prefer the email? Just head over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. Attention deal makers, I am buying. I buy houses and I buy apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Florida, as well as New Jersey and Delaware. So if you have a deal you'd like me to take a look at, one that I can make a profit on, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Are you an accredited investor who is interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. We've reached the end of this episode. I thank you, my loyal listener, for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.